No. Standing upright, he delivered the fact as a question of his own. Well, Hans, are you a member?
Of what?
But Hans Huberman knew exactly what the man was talking about. Come on, Hansi, Bollinger persisted. Don't make me spell it out. The tall painter waved him away and walked on. As the years passed by, the Jews were being terrorized at random throughout the country, and in the spring of 1937, almost to his shame, Hans Huberman finally submitted. He made some inquiries and applied to join the party. After lodging his form at the Nazi headquarters on Munich Street, he witnessed four men throw several bricks into a clothing store named Kleinmann's. It was one of the few Jewish shops that was still in operation in Mulking. Inside, a small man was stuttering about, crushing the broken glass beneath his feet as he cleaned up. A star the color of mustard was smeared to the door. In sloppy lettering, the words Jewish filth were spilling over at their edges. The movement inside tapered from hurried to morose, then stopped altogether. Hans moved closer and stuck his head inside.
Do you need some help?
Mr. Kleinmann looked up. A dust broom was fixed powerlessly to his hand.
No, Hans, please, go away.
Hans had painted Joel Kleinmann's house the previous year. He remembered his three children. He could see their faces, but couldn't recall their names.
I will come tomorrow, he said, and repaint your door.
Which he did. It was the second of two mistakes. The first occurred immediately after the incident. He returned to where he'd come from and drove his fist onto the door and then the window of the NSDAP. The glass shuddered, but no one replied. Everyone had packed up and gone home. A last member was walking in the opposite direction. When he heard the rattle of the glass, he noticed the painter. He came back and asked what was wrong.
I can no longer join, Hans stated.
The man was shocked.
Why not?
Hans looked at the knuckles of his right hand and swallowed. He could already taste the error, like a metal tablet in his mouth.
Forget it. He turned and walked home.
Words followed him.
You just think about it, Herr Huberman. Let us know what you decide.
He did not acknowledge them. The following morning, as promised, he rose earlier than usual, but not early enough. The door at Kleinmann's clothing was still moist with dew. Hans dried it. He managed to match the color as close as humanly possible and gave it a good solid coat. Innocuously, a man walked past.
Heil Hitler, he said.
Heil Hitler, Hans replied.
Three small but important facts. One, the man who walked past was Rolf Fischer, one of Mulking's greatest Nazis. Two, a new slur was painted on the door within 16 hours. Three, Hans Huberman was not granted membership in the Nazi Party. Not yet, anyway. For the next year, Hans was lucky that he didn't revoke his membership application officially. While many people were instantly approved, he was added to a waiting list, regarded with suspicion. Toward the end of 1938, when the Jews were cleared out completely after Kristallnacht, the Gestapo visited. They searched the house, and when nothing or no one suspicious was found, Hans Huberman was one of the fortunate. He was allowed to stay. What probably saved him was that people knew he was at least waiting for his application to be approved. For this, he was tolerated, if not endorsed as the competent painter he was. Then, there was his other savior. It was the accordion that most likely spared him from total ostracism. Painters there were from all over Munich, but under the brief tutorage of Erich Vandenberg and nearly 2 decades of his own steady practice, there was no one in Mulking who could play exactly like him. It was a style not of perfection, but warmth. Even mistakes had a good feeling about them. He Heil Hitlered when it was asked of him, and he flew the flag on the right days. There was no apparent problem. Then, on June the 16th, 1939, the date was like cement now, just over 6 months after Liesel's arrival on Himmel Street, an event occurred that altered the life of Hans Hubermann irreversibly. It was a day in which he had some work. He left the house at 7 a.m. sharp. He towed his paint cart behind him, oblivious to the fact that he was being followed. When he arrived at the work site, a young stranger walked up to him. He was blonde and tall and serious. The pair watched each other.
"Would you be Hans Hubermann?"
Hans gave him a single nod. He was reaching for a paintbrush.
"Yes, I would." "Do you play the accordion, by any chance?"
This time Hans stopped, leaving the brush where it was. Again he nodded. The stranger rubbed his jaw, looked around him, and then spoke with great quietness, yet great clarity.
"Are you a man who likes to keep a promise?"
Hans took out 2 paint cans and invited him to sit down. Before he accepted the invitation, the young man extended his hand and introduced himself.
"My name's Kugler. Walter. I come from Stuttgart."
They sat and talked quietly for 15 minutes or so, arranging a meeting for later on, in the night.
A Good Girl.
In November 1940, when Max Vandenberg arrived in the kitchen of 33 Himmel Street, he was 24 years old. His clothes seemed to weigh him down, and his tiredness was such that an itch could break him in two. He stood shaking and shaken in the doorway.
"Do you still play the accordion?" Of course, the question was really, "Will you still help me?"
Liesl's papa walked to the front door and opened it. Cautiously, he looked outside each way and returned. The verdict was nothing. Max Vandenberg, the Jew, closed his eyes and drooped a little further into safety. The very idea of it was ludicrous, but he accepted it nonetheless. Hans checked that the curtains were properly closed. Not a crack could be showing. As he did so, Max could no longer bear it. He crouched down and clasped his hands. The darkness stroked him. His fingers smelt of suitcase, metal, Mein Kampf, and survival. It was only when he lifted his head that the dim light from the hallway reached his eyes. He noticed the pajamaed girl standing there in full view.
"Papa?"
Max stood up like a struck match. The darkness swelled now around him.
"Everything's fine, Liesl," Papa said. "Go back to bed."
She lingered a moment before her feet dragged from behind. When she stopped and stole one last look at the foreigner in the kitchen, she could decipher the outline of a book on the table.
"Don't be afraid," she heard Papa whisper. "She's a good girl."
For the next hour, the good girl lay wide awake in bed, listening to the quiet fumbling of sentences in the kitchen. One wild card was yet to be played. A Short History of the Jewish Fist Fighter. Max Vandenberg was born in 1916. He grew up in Stuttgart. When he was younger, he grew to love nothing more than a good fist fight. He had his first bout when he was 11 years old and skinny as a whittled broom handle. Wenzel Gruber, that's who he fought. He had a smart mouth, that Gruber kid, and wire curly hair. The local playground demanded that they fight, and neither boy was about to argue. They fought like champions. For a minute. Just when it was getting interesting, both boys were hauled away by their collars. A watchful parent. A trickle of blood was dripping from Max's mouth. He tasted it, and it tasted good. Not many people who came from his neighborhood were fighters, and if they were, they didn't do it with their fists. In those days, they said the Jews preferred to simply stand and take things, take the abuse quietly, and then work their way back to the top. Obviously, every Jew is not the same. He was nearly 2 years old when his father died, shot to pieces on a grassy hill. When he was 9, his mother was completely broke. She sold the music studio that doubled as their apartment, and they moved to his uncle's house. There he grew up with 6 cousins who battered, annoyed, and loved him. Fighting with the oldest one, Isaac, was the training ground for his fist fighting. He was trounced almost every night. At 13, tragedy struck again when his uncle died. As percentages would suggest, his uncle was not a hothead like Max. He was the type of person who worked quietly away for very little reward. He kept to himself and sacrificed everything for his family. And he died of something growing in his stomach, something akin to a poisoned bowling ball. As is often the case, the family surrounded the bed and watched him capitulate. Somehow, between the sadness and loss, Max Vandenberg, who was now a teenager with hard hands, blackened eyes, and a sore tooth, was also a little disappointed, even disgruntled. As he watched his uncle sink slowly into the bed, he decided that he would never allow himself to die like that. The man's face was so accepting, so yellow and tranquil, despite the violent architecture of his skull, the endless jawline stretching for miles, the pop-up cheekbones, and the pothole eyes. So calm it made the boy want to ask something. "Where's the fight?" he wondered. "Where's the will to hold on?" Of course, at 13 he was a little excessive in his harshness. He had not looked something like me in the face. Not yet. With the rest of them, he stood around the bed and watched the man die. A safe merge from life to death. The light in the window was grey and orange, the colour of summer's skin, and his uncle appeared relieved when his breathing disappeared completely. "When death captures me," the boy vowed, "he will feel my fist on his face." Personally, I quite like that, such stupid gallantry. Yes, I like that a lot. From that moment on, he started to fight with greater regularity. A group of die-hard friends and enemies would gather down at a small reserve on Staber Street, and they would fight in the dying light. Archetypal Germans, the odd Jew, the boys from the East, it didn't matter. There was nothing like a good fight to expel the teenage energy. Even the enemies were an inch away from friendship. He enjoyed the tight circles and the unknown, the bitter sweetness of uncertainty, to win or to lose. It was a feeling in the stomach that would be stirred around until he thought he could no longer tolerate it. The only remedy was to move forward and throw punches. Max was not the type of boy to die thinking about it. His favorite fight, now that he looked back, was fight number 5, against a tall, tough, rangy kid named Walter Kugler. They were 15. Walter had won all 4 of their previous encounters, but this time Max could feel something different. There was new blood in him, the blood of victory, and it had the capability to both frighten and excite. As always, there was a tight circle crowded around them. There was grubby ground, there were smiles practically wrapped around the onlooking faces. Money was clutched in filthy fingers, and the calls and cries were filled with such vitality that there was nothing else but this. God, there was such joy and fear there, such brilliant commotion. The two fighters were clenched with the intensity of the moment, their faces loaded up with expression, exaggerated with the stress of it, the wide-eyed concentration. After a minute or so of testing each other out, they began moving closer and taking more risks. It was a street fight, after all, not an hour-long title fight. They didn't have all day. "Come on, Max," one of his friends was calling out. There was no breath between any of the words. "Come on, Maxi-Taxi, you've got him now, you've got him, Jew boy, you've got him, you've got him." A small kid with soft tufts of hair, a beaten nose, and swampy eyes, Max was a good head shorter than his opposition. His fighting style was utterly graceless, all bent over, nudging forward, throwing fast punches at the face of Kugler. The other boy, clearly stronger and more skillful, remained upright, throwing jabs that constantly landed on Max's cheeks and chin. Max kept coming. Even with the heavy absorption of punches and punishment, he continued moving forward. Blood discolored his lips. It would soon be dried across his teeth. There was a great roar when he was knocked down. Money was almost exchanged. Max stood up. He was beaten down one more time before he changed tactics, luring Walter Kugler a little closer than he'd wanted to come. Once he was there, Max was able to apply a short, sharp jab to his face. It stuck exactly on the nose. Kugler, suddenly blinded, shuffled back, and Max seized his chance. He followed him over to the right and jabbed him once more and opened him up with a punch that reached into his ribs. The right hand that ended him landed on his chin. Walter Kugler was on the ground, his blonde hair peppered with dirt. His legs were parted in a V. Tears like crystal floated down his skin, despite the fact that he was not crying. The tears had been bashed out of him. The circle counted. They always counted, just in case. Voices and numbers. The custom after a fight was that the loser would raise the hand of the victor. When Kugler finally stood up, he walked sullenly to Max Vandenberg and lifted his arm into the air. "Thanks," Max told him. Kugler proffered a warning. "Next time, I kill you." Altogether, over the next few years, Max Vandenberg and Walter Kugler fought 13 times. Walter was always seeking revenge for that first victory Max took from him, and Max was looking to emulate his moment of glory. In the end, the record stood at 10-3 for Walter. They fought each other until 1933, when they were 17. Grudging respect turned to genuine friendship, and the urge to fight left them. Both held jobs until Max was sacked with the rest of the Jews at the Jedermann engineering factory in 35. That wasn't long after the Nuremberg laws came in, forbidding Jews to have German citizenship, and for Germans and Jews to intermarry. "Jesus," Walter said one evening when they met on the small corner where they used to fight. "That was a time, wasn't it? There was none of this around." He gave the star on Max's sleeve a backhanded slap. "We could never fight like that now." Max disagreed. "Yes, we could. You can't marry a Jew, but there's no law against fighting one." Walter smiled. "There's probably a law rewarding it, as long as you win." For the next few years, they saw each other sporadically at best. Max, with the rest of the Jews, was steadily rejected and repeatedly trodden upon, while Walter disappeared inside his job, a printing firm. If you're the type who's interested, yes, there were a few girls in those years. One named Tanya, the other Hildy. Neither of them lasted. There was no time, most likely due to the uncertainty and mounting pressure. Max needed to scavenge for work. What could he offer those girls? By 1938, it was difficult to imagine that life could get any harder. Then came November the 9th, Kristallnacht, the night of broken glass. It was the very incident that destroyed so many of his fellow Jews, but it proved to be Max Vandenberg's moment of escape. He was 22. Many Jewish establishments were being surgically smashed and looted when there was a clatter of knuckles on the apartment door. With his aunt, his mother, his cousins and their children, Max was crammed into the living room. "Aufmachen!" The family watched each other. There was a great temptation to scatter into the other rooms, but apprehension is the strangest thing. They couldn't move. Again. "Open up!" Isaac stood and walked to the door. The wood was alive, still humming from the beating it had just been given. He looked back at the faces, naked with fear, turned the lock, and opened the door. As expected, it was a Nazi, in uniform. "Never," that was Max's first response. He clung to his mother's hand and that of Sarah, the nearest of his cousins. "I won't leave. If we all can't go, I don't go either." He was lying. When he was pushed out by the rest of his family, the relief struggled inside him like an obscenity. It was something he didn't want to feel, but nonetheless he felt it with such gusto it made him want to throw up. How could he? How could he? But he did. "Bring nothing," Walter told him. "Just what you're wearing. I'll give you the rest." "Max," it was his mother. From a drawer, she took an old piece of paper and stuffed it in his jacket pocket. If ever... She held him one last time by the elbows. This could be your last hope. He looked into her aging face and kissed her very hard on the lips.
Come on. Walter pulled at him as the rest of the family said their goodbyes and gave him money and a few valuables. It's chaos out there, and chaos is what we need.
They left, without looking back. It tortured him. If only he turned for one last look at his family as he left the apartment. Perhaps then the guilt would not have been so heavy. No final goodbye. No final grip of the eyes. Nothing but goneness. For the next 2 years, he remained in hiding, in an empty storeroom. It was in a building where Walter had worked in previous years. There was very little food. There was plenty of suspicion. The remaining Jews with money in the neighborhood were emigrating. The Jews without money were also trying, but without much success. Max's family fell into the latter category. Walter checked on them occasionally, as inconspicuously as he could. One afternoon, when he visited, someone else opened the door. When Max heard the news, his body felt like it was being screwed up into a ball, like a page littered with mistakes, like garbage. Yet each day, he managed to unravel and straighten himself, disgusted and thankful. Wrecked, but somehow not torn into pieces. Halfway through 1939, just over 6 months into the period of hiding, they decided that a new course of action needed to be taken. They examined the piece of paper Max was handed upon his desertion. That's right, his desertion, not only his escape. That was how he viewed it, amid the grotesquerie of his relief. We already know what was written on that piece of paper. One name, one address. Hans Hubermann, Himmel Street 33, Malking.
It's getting worse, Walter told Max. Any time now they could find us out.
There was much hunching in the dark.
We don't know what might happen. I might get caught. You might need to find that place. I'm too scared to ask anyone for help here. They might put me in.
There was only one solution.
I'll go down there and find this man. If he's turned into a Nazi, which is very likely, I'll just turn around. At least we know then.
Richtig? Max gave him every last pfennig to make the trip. And a few days later, when Walter returned, they embraced before he held his breath. And?
Walter nodded. He's good. He still plays that accordion your mother told you about, your father's. He's not a member of the party. He gave me money.
At this stage, Hans Hubermann was only a list.
He's fairly poor, he's married, and there's a kid.
This sparked Max's attention even further. How old?
10. You can't have everything.
Yes, kids have big mouths.
We are lucky as it is.
They sat in silence a while. It was Max who disturbed it. He must already hate me, huh?
I don't think so. He gave me the money, didn't he? He said a promise is a promise.
A week later, a letter came. Hans notified Walter Kugler that he would try to send things to help whenever he could. There was a one-page map of Malking and Greater Munich, as well as a direct route from Passing, the more reliable train station, to his front door. In his letter, the last words were obvious. Be careful. Midway through May 1940, Mein Kampf arrived, with a key taped to the inside cover. The man's a genius, Max decided. But there was still a shudder when he thought about traveling to Munich. Clearly he wished, along with the other parties involved, that the journey would not have to be made at all. You don't always get what you wish for. Especially in Nazi Germany. Again, time passed. The war expanded. Max remained hidden from the world in another empty room. Until the inevitable. Walter was notified that he was being sent to Poland, to continue the assertion of Germany's authority over both the Poles and Jews alike. One was not much better than the other. The time had come. Max made his way to Munich and Malking, and now he sat in a stranger's kitchen, asking for the help he craved and suffering the condemnation he felt he deserved. Hans Hubermann shook his hand and introduced himself. He made him some coffee in the dark. The girl had been gone quite a while, but now some more footsteps had approached a rival. The wild card. In the darkness, all three of them were completely isolated. They all stared. Only the woman spoke. The Wrath of Rosa. Liesel had drifted back to sleep when the unmistakable voice of Rosa Huberman entered the kitchen. It shocked her awake.
Was ist los?
Curiosity got the better of her then, as she imagined a tirade thrown down from the Wrath of Rosa. There was definite movement and the shuffle of a chair. After 10 minutes of excruciating discipline, Liesel made her way to the corridor, and what she saw truly amazed her, because Rosa Huberman was at Max Vandenberg's shoulder, watching him gulp down her infamous pea soup. Candlelight was standing at the table. It did not waver. Mama was grave. Her plump figure glowed with worry. Somehow, though, there was also a look of triumph on her face. And it was not the triumph of having saved another human being from persecution. It was something more along the lines of, "See? At least he's not complaining." She looked from the soup to the Jew to the soup. When she spoke again, she asked only if he wanted more. Max declined, preferring instead to rush to the sink and vomit. His back convulsed and his arms were well spread. His fingers gripped the metal. "Jesus, Mary and Joseph," Rosa muttered. "Another one." Turning around, Max apologized. His words were slippery and small, quelled by the acid. "I'm sorry. I think I ate too much. My stomach, you know, it's been so long since..." "I don't think it can handle such..." "Move," Rosa ordered him. She started cleaning up. When she was finished, she found the young man at the kitchen table, utterly morose. Hans was sitting opposite, his hands cupped above the sheet of wood. Liesel, from the hallway, could see the drawn face of the stranger, and behind it, the worried expression scribbled like a mess onto Mama. She looked at both her foster parents. Who were these people? Liesel's lecture. Exactly what kind of people Hans and Rosa Huberman were was not the easiest problem to solve. Kind people? Ridiculously ignorant people? People of questionable sanity? What was easier to define was their predicament. The situation of Hans and Rosa Huberman. Very sticky indeed. In fact, frightfully sticky. When a Jew shows up at your place of residence in the early hours of morning, in the very birthplace of Nazism, you're likely to experience extreme levels of discomfort. Anxiety, disbelief, paranoia, each plays its part, and each leads to a sneaking suspicion that a less-than-heavenly consequence awaits. The fear is shiny, ruthless in the eyes. The surprising point to make is that despite this iridescent fear glowing as it did in the dark, they somehow resisted the urge for hysteria. Mama ordered Liesel away. "Bet, sau Mensch," the voice calm but firm, highly unusual. Papa came in a few minutes later and lifted the covers on the vacant bed. "Alles gut, Liesel? Is everything good?"
"Yes, Papa."
"As you can see, we have a visitor." She could only just make out the shape of Hans Huberman's tallness in the dark. "He'll sleep in here tonight."
"Yes, Papa."
A few minutes later, Max Vandenberg was in the room, noiseless and opaque. The man did not breathe. He did not move. Yet somehow he travelled from the doorway to the bed and was under the covers. "Everything good?" It was Papa again, talking this time to Max. The reply floated from his mouth, then moulded itself like a stain to the ceiling. Such was his feeling of shame.
Yes, thank you.
He said it again, when Papa made his way over to his customary position in the chair next to Liesel's bed.
Thank you.
Another hour passed before Liesel fell asleep. She slept hard and long. A hand woke her just after 8:30 the next morning. The voice at the end of it informed her that she would not be attending school that day. Apparently, she was sick. When she awoke completely, she watched the stranger in the bed opposite. The blanket showed only a nest of lopsided hair at the top, and there was not a sound, as if he'd somehow trained himself even to sleep more quietly. With great care, she walked the length of him, following Papa to the hall. For the first time ever, the kitchen and Mama were dormant. It was a kind of bemused, inaugural silence. To Liesel's relief, it lasted only a few minutes. There was food and the sound of eating. Mama announced the day's priority. She sat at the table and said, "Now, listen, Liesel, Papa's going to tell you something today." This was serious. She didn't even say Zaumensch. It was a personal feat of abstinence. "He'll talk to you, and you have to listen. Is that clear?" The girl was still swallowing. "Is that clear, Zaumensch?" That was better. The girl nodded. When she re-entered the bedroom to fetch her clothes, the body in the opposite bed had turned and curled up. It was no longer a straight log, but a kind of Z-shape, reaching diagonally from corner to corner, zigzagging the bed. She could see his face now, in the tired light. His mouth was open, and his skin was the color of eggshells. Whiskers coated his jaw and chin, and his ears were hard and flat. He had a small but misshapen nose.
"Liesel!" She turned. "Move it!"
She moved, to the washroom. Once changed and in the hallway, she realized she would not be traveling far. Papa was standing in front of the door to the basement. He smiled very faintly, lit the lamp, and led her down. Among the mounds of drop sheets and the smell of paint, Papa told her to make herself comfortable. Ignited on the walls were the painted words learned in the past. "I need to tell you some things." Liesel sat on top of a meter-tall heap of drop sheets, Papa on a 15-liter paint can. For a few minutes, he searched for the words. When they came, he stood to deliver them. He rubbed his eyes. "Liesel," he said quietly, "I was never sure if any of this would happen, so I never told you. About me, about the men upstairs." He walked from one end of the basement to the other, the lamplight magnifying his shadow. It turned him into a giant on the wall, walking back and forth. When he stopped pacing, his shadow loomed behind him, watching. Someone was always watching. "You know my accordion?" he said. And there the story began. He explained World War I and Erich Vandenberg, and then the visit to the fallen soldier's wife. "The boy who came into the room that day is the man upstairs. Verstehst? Understand?" The book thief sat and listened to Hans Hubermann's story. It lasted a good hour, until the moment of truth, which involved a very obvious and necessary lecture. "Liesel, you must listen." Papa made her stand up and held her hand. They faced the wall. Dark shapes and the practice of words. Firmly, he held her fingers. "Remember the Führer's birthday? When we walked home from the fire that night? Remember what you promised me?" The girl concurred. To the wall she said,
"That I would keep a secret."
"That's right." Between the hand-holding shadows, the painted words were scattered about, perched on their shoulders, resting on their heads, and hanging from their arms. "Liesel, if you tell anyone about the men up there, we will all be in big trouble." He walked the fine line of scaring her into oblivion and soothing her enough to keep her calm. He fed her the sentences and watched with his metallic eyes. Desperation and placidity. At the very least, Mama and I will be taken away. Hans was clearly worried that he was on the verge of frightening her too much, but he calculated the risk, preferring to err on the side of too much fear rather than not enough. The girl's compliance had to be an absolute, immutable fact. Toward the end, Hans Hubermann looked at Liesel Memminger and made certain she was focused. He gave her a list of consequences. If you tell anyone about that man, her teacher, Rudy, it didn't matter whom. What mattered was that all were punishable. For starters, he said, I will take each and every one of your books, and I will burn them. It was callous. I'll throw them in the stove or the fireplace. He was certainly acting like a tyrant, but it was necessary. Understand? The shock made a hole in her, very neat, very precise. Tears welled. Yes, Papa. Next. He had to remain hard, and he needed to strain for it. They'll take you away from me. Do you want that? She was crying now in earnest.
Nein.
Good. His grip on her hand tightened. They'll drag that man up there away, and maybe Mama and me too, and we will never, ever come back. And that did it. The girl began to sob so uncontrollably that Papa was dying to pull her into him and hug her tight. He didn't. Instead, he squatted down and watched her directly in the eyes. He unleashed his quietest words so far. Verstehst du mich? Do you understand me? The girl nodded. She cried. And now, defeated, broken, her papa held her in the painted air and the kerosene light.
I understand, Papa. I do.
Her voice was muffled against his body, and they stayed like that for a few minutes, Liesel with squashed breath, and Papa rubbing her back. Upstairs, when they returned, they found Mama sitting in the kitchen alone and pensive. When she saw them, she stood and beckoned Liesel to come over, noticing the dried-up tears that streaked her. She brought the girl into her and heaped a typically rugged embrace around her body. Alles gut, so much? She didn't need an answer. Everything was good, but it was awful, too. The Sleeper. Max Vandenberg slept for 3 days. In certain excerpts of that sleep, Liesel watched him. You might say that by the third day it became an obsession, to check on him, to see if he was still breathing. She could now interpret his signs of life, from the movement of his lips, his gathering beard, and the twigs of hair that moved ever so slightly when his head twitched in the dream state. Often, when she stood over him, there was the mortifying thought that he had just woken up, his eyes splitting open to view her, to watch her watching. The idea of being caught out plagued and infused her at the same time. She dreaded it. She invited it. Only when Mama called out to her could she drag herself away, simultaneously soothed and disappointed that she might not be there when he woke. Sometimes, close to the end of the marathon of sleep, he spoke. There was a recital of murmured names, a checklist. Isaac, Aunt Ruth, Sarah, Mama, Walter, Hitler. Family, friend, enemy. They were all under the covers with him, and at one point he appeared to be struggling with himself. Nein, he whispered. It was repeated 7 times. No. Liesel, in the act of watching, was already noticing the similarities between this stranger and herself. They both arrived in a state of agitation on Himmel Street. They both nightmared. When the time came, he awoke with a nasty thrill of disorientation. His mouth opened a moment after his eyes, and he sat up, right-angled.
Aye.
A patch of voice escaped his mouth. When he saw the upside-down face of a girl above him, there was the fretful moment of unfamiliarity and the grasp for a recollection, to decode exactly where and when he was currently sitting. After a few seconds, he managed to scratch his head, the rustle of kindling, and he looked at her. His movements were fragmented, and now that they were open, his eyes were swampy and brown, thick and heavy. As a reflex action, Liesel backed away. She was too slow. The stranger reached out, his bed-warmed hand taking her by the forearm.
Please.
His voice also held on, as if possessing fingernails. He pressed it into her flesh.
Papa!
Loud.
Please.
Soft. It was late afternoon, grey and gleaming, but it was only dirty coloured light that was permitted entrance into the room. It was all the fabric of the curtains allowed. If you're optimistic, think of it as bronze. When Papa came in, he first stood in the doorway and witnessed Max Vandenberg's gripping fingers and his desperate face. Both held onto Liesel's arm. "I see you two have met," he said. Max's fingers started cooling. The Swapping of Nightmares. Max Vandenberg promised that he would never sleep in Liesel's room again. What was he thinking that first night? The very idea of it mortified him. He rationalized that he was so bewildered upon his arrival that he allowed such a thing. The basement was the only place for him, as far as he was concerned. Forget the cold and the loneliness. He was a Jew, and if there was one place he was destined to exist, it was a basement or any other such hidden venue of survival. "I'm sorry," he confessed to Hans and Rosa on the basement steps. "From now on, I will stay down here. You will not hear from me. I will not make a sound." Hans and Rosa, both steeped in the despair of the predicament, made no argument, not even in regard to the cold. They heaved blankets down and topped up the kerosene lamp. Rosa admitted that there could not be much food, to which Max fervently asked her to bring only scraps, and only when they were not wanted by anyone else. "Na, na," Rosa assured him, "you will be fed as best I can." They also took the mattress down from the spare bed in Liesel's room, replacing it with drop sheets. An excellent trade. Downstairs, Hans and Max placed the mattress beneath the steps and built a wall of drop sheets at the side. The sheets were high enough to cover the whole triangular entrance, and if nothing else, they were easily moved if Max was in dire need of extra air. Papa apologized. "It's quite pathetic, I realize that." "Better than nothing," Max assured him. "Better than I deserve. Thank you." With some well-positioned paint cans, Hans actually conceded that it did simply look like a collection of junk gathered sloppily in the corner, out of the way. The one problem was that a person needed only to shift a few cans and remove a drop sheet or two to smell out the Jew.
"Let's just hope it's good enough," he said.
"It has to be." Max crawled in. Again he said it. "Thank you." "Thank you." For Max Vandenberg, those were the two most pitiful words he could possibly say, rivaled only by "I'm sorry." There was a constant urge to speak both expressions, spurred on by the affliction of guilt. How many times in those first few hours of awakeness did he feel like walking out of that basement and leaving the house altogether? It must have been hundreds. Each time, though, it was only a twinge, which made it even worse. He wanted to walk out. Lord, how he wanted to. Or at least, he wanted to want to. But he knew he wouldn't. It was much the same as the way he left his family in Stuttgart, under a veil of fabricated loyalty. To live. Living was living. The price was guilt and shame. For his first few days in the basement, Liesel had nothing to do with him. She denied his existence, his rustling hair, his cold, slippery fingers, his tortured presence. Mama and Papa. There was such gravity between them, and a lot of failed decision-making. They considered whether they could move him. But where? No reply. In this situation, they were friendless and paralyzed. There was nowhere else for Max Vandenberg to go. It was them. Hans and Rosa Huberman. Liesel had never seen them look at each other so much, or with such solemnity. It was they who took the food down and organized an empty paint can for Max's excrement. The contents would be disposed of by Hans, as prudently as possible. Rosa also took him some buckets of hot water to wash himself. The Jew was filthy. Outside, a mountain of cold November air was waiting at the front door each time Liesel left the house. Drizzle came down in spades. Dead leaves were slumped on the road. Soon enough, it was the book thief's turn to visit the basement. They made her. She walked tentatively down the steps, knowing that no words were required. The scuffing of her feet was enough to rouse him. In the middle of the basement, she stood and waited, feeling more like she was standing in the center of a great dusky field. The sun was setting behind a crop of harvested drop sheets. When Max came out, he was holding Mein Kampf. Upon his arrival, he'd offered it back to Hans Huberman, but was told he could keep it. Naturally, Liesel, while holding the dinner, couldn't take her eyes off it. It was a book she had seen a few times at the BDM, but it hadn't been read or used directly in their activities. There were occasional references to its greatness, as well as promises that the opportunity to study it would come in later years, as they progressed into the more senior Hitler Youth Division. Max, following her attention, also examined the book. "Is?" she whispered. There was a queer strand in her voice, planed off and curly in her mouth. The Jew moved only his head a little closer. "Bitte? Excuse me?" She handed him the pea soup and returned upstairs, red, rushed, and foolish. "Is it a good book?" She practiced what she'd wanted to say in the washroom, in the small mirror. The smell of urine was still about her, as Max had just used the paint can before she'd come down. "So ein Gestank," she thought. "What a stink." No one's urine smells as good as your own. The days hobbled on. Each night, before the descent into sleep, she would hear Mama and Papa in the kitchen discussing what had been done, what they were doing now, and what needed to happen next. All the while, an image of Max hovered next to her. It was always the injured, thankful expression on his face, and the swamp-filled eyes. Only once was there an outburst in the kitchen. "Papa, I know." His voice was abrasive, but he brought it back to a muffled whisper in a hurry. "I have to keep going, though, at least a few times a week. I can't be here all the time. We need the money, and if I quit playing there, they'll get suspicious. They might wonder why I've stopped. I told them you were sick last week, but now we have to do everything like we always have." Therein lay the problem. Life had altered in the wildest possible way, but it was imperative that they act as if nothing at all had happened. Imagine smiling after a slap in the face. Then think of doing it 24 hours a day. That was the business of hiding a Jew. As days turned into weeks, there was now, if nothing else, a beleaguered acceptance of what had transpired. All the result of war, a promise keeper, and one piano accordion. Also, in the space of just over half a year, the Hubermans had lost a son, and gained a replacement of epically dangerous proportions. What shocked Liesel most was the change in her mama. Whether it was the calculated way in which she divided the food, or the considerable muzzling of her notorious mouth, or even the gentler expression on her cardboard face, one thing was becoming clear. An attribute of Rosa Huberman. She was a good woman for a crisis. Even when the arthritic Helena Schmidt cancelled the washing and ironing service a month after Max's debut on Himmel Street, she simply sat at the table and brought the bowl to water. "Good soup tonight?" The soup was terrible. Every morning when Liesel left for school, or on the days she ventured out to play soccer or complete what was left of the washing round, Rosa would speak quietly to the girl. "And remember, Liesel," she would point to her mouth, and that was all. When Liesel nodded, she would say, "Good girl, Saumensch. Now get going." True to Papa's words, and even Mama's now, she was a good girl. She kept her mouth shut everywhere she went. The secret was buried deep. She town-walked with Rudy, as she always did, listening to his jabbering. Sometimes they compared notes from their Hitler Youth divisions, Rudy mentioning for the first time a sadistic young leader named Franz Deutscher. If Rudy wasn't talking about Deutscher's intense ways, he was playing his usual broken record, providing renditions and recreations of the last goal he scored in the Himmel Street soccer stadium.
"I know," Liesel would assure him. "I was there."
"So what?"
"So I saw it, Saukerl." "How do I know that? For all I know, you were probably on the ground somewhere, licking up the mud I left behind when I scored."
Perhaps it was Rudy who kept her sane, with the stupidity of his talk, his lemon-soaked hair, and his cockiness. He seemed to resonate with a kind of confidence that life was still nothing but a joke, an endless succession of soccer goals, trickery, and a constant repertoire of meaningless chatter. Also, there was the mayor's wife and reading in her husband's library. It was cold in there now, colder with every visit, but still Liesel could not stay away. She would choose a handful of books and read small segments of each until one afternoon she found one she could not put down. It was called The Whistler. She was originally drawn to it because of her sporadic sightings of the Whistler of Himmel Street, Pfiffikus. There was the memory of him bent over in his coat and his appearance at the bonfire on the Führer's birthday. The first event in the book was a murder, a stabbing, a Vienna street, not far from the Stephansdom, the cathedral in the main square. A small excerpt from The Whistler. She lay there, frightened, in a pool of blood, a strange tune singing in her ear. She recalled the knife, in and out, and a smile. As always, The Whistler had smiled as he ran away, into a dark and murderous night. Liesel was unsure whether it was the words or the open window that caused her to tremble. Every time she picked up or delivered from the mayor's house, she read three pages and shivered. But she could not last forever. Similarly, Max Vandenberg could not withstand the basement much longer. He didn't complain, he had no right, but he could slowly feel himself deteriorating in the cold. As it turned out, his rescue owed itself to some reading and writing, and a book called The Shoulder Shrug. "Liesel," said Hans one night, "come on." Since Max's arrival, there had been a considerable hiatus in the reading practice of Liesel and her papa. He clearly felt that now was a good time to resume. "Now come," he told her, "I don't want you slacking off. Go and get one of your books. How about The Shoulder Shrug?" The disturbing element in all of this was that when she came back, book in hand, Papa was motioning that she should follow him down to their old workroom, the basement.
"But Papa," she tried to tell him, "we can't."
"What, is there a monster down there?"
It was early December, and the day had been icy. The basement became unfriendlier with each concrete step.
"It's too cold, Papa."
"That never bothered you before?"
"Yes, but it was never this cold."
When they made their way down, Papa whispered to Max, "Can we borrow the lamplight, please?" With trepidation, the sheets and cans moved, and the light was passed out, exchanging hands. Looking at the flame, Hans shook his head and followed it with some words.
"Es ist ja Wahnsinn, ne? This is crazy, no?"
Before the hand from within could reposition the sheets, he caught it.
"Bring yourself too, please, Max."
Slowly then the drop sheets were dragged aside, and the emaciated body and face of Max Vandenberg appeared. In the moist light, he stood with a magic discomfort. He shivered, Hans touched his arm to bring him closer.
Jesus, Mary and Joseph, you cannot stay down here. You'll freeze to death.
He turned. Liesel, fill up the tub, not too hot. Make it just like it is when it starts cooling down. Liesel ran up.
Jesus, Mary and Joseph.
She heard it again when she reached the hallway. When he was in the pint-sized bath, Liesel listened at the washroom door, imagining the tepid water turning to steam as it warmed his iceberg body. Mama and Papa were at the climax of debate in the combined bedroom and living room, their quiet voices trapped inside the corridor wall.
You'll die down there, I promise you.
But what if someone sees in?
No, he only comes up at night. In the day, we leave everything open, nothing to hide. And we use this room rather than the kitchen, best to keep away from the front door.
Silence. Then Mama.
All right. Yes, you're right.
If we gamble on a Jew, said Papa soon after, I would prefer to gamble on a live one.
And from that moment, a new routine was born. Each night, the fire was lit in Mama and Papa's room, and Max would silently appear. He would sit in the corner, cramped and perplexed, most likely by the kindness of the people, the torment of survival, and overriding all of it, the brilliance of the warmth. With the curtains clamped tight, he would sleep on the floor with a cushion beneath his head as the fire slipped away and turned to ash. In the morning, he would return to the basement, a voiceless human, the Jewish rat, back to his hole. Christmas came and went with the smell of extra danger. As expected, Hans Jr. did not come home, both a blessing and an ominous disappointment. But Trudy arrived as usual, and fortunately, things went smoothly. The qualities of smoothness. Max remained in the basement. Trudy came and went, without any suspicion. It was decided that Trudy, despite her mild demeanor, could not be trusted.
We trust only the people we have to, Papa stated, and that is the three of us.
There was extra food, and the apology to Max that this was not his religion, but a ritual nonetheless.
He didn't complain. What grounds did he have?
He explained that he was a Jew in upbringing, in blood, but also that Jewry was now more than ever a label, a ruinous piece of the dumbest luck around. It was then that he also took the opportunity to say he was sorry that the Huberman's son had not come home. In response, Papa told him that such things were out of their control. After all, he said, you should know it yourself. A young man is still a boy, and a boy sometimes has the right to be stubborn. They left it at that. For the first few weeks in front of the fire, Max remained wordless. Now that he was having a proper bath once a week, Liesel noticed that his hair was no longer a nest of twigs, but rather a collection of feathers flopping about on his head. Still shy of the stranger, she whispered it to her papa.
His hair is like feathers.
What?
The fire had distorted the words.
I said, she whispered again, leaning closer, his hair is like feathers.
Hans Huberman looked across and nodded his agreement. I'm sure he was wishing to have eyes like the girl. They didn't realize that Max had heard everything. Occasionally, he brought the copy of Mein Kampf and read it next to the flames, seething at the content. The third time he brought it, Liesel finally found the courage to ask her question.
Is it good?
He looked up from the pages, forming his fingers into a fist and then flattening them back out. Sweeping away the anger, he smiled at her. He lifted the feathery fringe and dumped it toward his eyes. It's the best book ever. Looking at Papa, then back at the girl, it saved my life. The girl moved a little and crossed her legs. Quietly, she asked it.
How?
So began a kind of storytelling phase in the living room each night. It was spoken just loud enough to hear. The pieces of a Jewish fist-fighting puzzle were assembled before them all. Sometimes there was humor in Max Vandenberg's voice, though its physicality was like friction, like a stone being gently rubbed across a large rock. It was deep in places and scratched apart in others, sometimes breaking off altogether. It was deepest in regret and broken off at the end of a joke or a statement of self-deprecation. "Crucified Christ!" was the most common reaction to Max Vandenberg's stories, usually followed by a question. Questions like, "How long did you stay in that room? Where is Walter Kugler now? Do you know what happened to your family? Where was the snorer traveling to? A 10-3 losing record, why would you keep fighting him?" When Liesl looked back on the events of her life, those nights in the living room were some of the clearest memories she had. She could see the burning light on Max's eggshell face, and even taste the human flavor of his words. The course of his survival was related piece by piece, as if he were cutting each part out of him and presenting it on a plate. "I'm so selfish." When he said that, he used his forearm to shield his face. "Leaving people behind, coming here, putting all of you in danger." He dropped everything out of him and started pleading with them. Sorrow and desolation were clouted across his face. "I'm sorry. Do you believe me? I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm..." His arm touched the fire, and he snapped it back. They all watched him, silent, until Papa stood and walked closer. He sat next to him. "Did you burn your elbow?" One evening, Hans, Max, and Liesl were sitting in front of the fire. Mama was in the kitchen. Max was reading Mein Kampf again. "You know something?" Hans said. He leaned toward the fire. "Liesl's actually a good little reader herself." Max lowered the book. "And she has more in common with you than you might think." Papa checked that Rosa wasn't coming. "She likes a good fist fight, too."
"Papa!"
Liesl, at the high end of 11 and still rake skinny as she sat against the wall, was devastated.
"I've never been in a fight."
"Shh!" Papa laughed. He waved at her to keep her voice down and tilted again, this time to the girl. "Well, what about the hiding you gave Ludwig Schmeichel, huh?"
"I never..."
She was caught. Further denial was useless.
"How did you find out about that?"
"I saw his papa at the Knoller."
Liesl held her face in her hands. Once uncovered again, she asked the pivotal question.
"Did you tell Mama?"
"Are you kidding?" He winked at Max and whispered to the girl.
"You're still alive, aren't you?"
That night was also the first time Papa played his accordion at home for months. It lasted half an hour or so until he asked a question of Max.
"Did you learn?" The face in the corner watched the flames.
"I did."
There was a considerable pause.
"Until I was 9.
At that age, my mother sold the music studio and stopped teaching. She kept only the one instrument, but gave up on me not long after I resisted the learning. I was foolish."
"No," Papa said. "You were a boy."
During the nights, both Liesl Memminger and Max Vandenberg would go about their other similarity. In their separate rooms, they would dream their nightmares and wake up, one with a scream in drowning sheets, the other with a gasp for air next to a smoking fire. Sometimes, when Liesl was reading with Papa close to 3 o'clock, they would both hear the waking moment of Max.
"He dreams like you," Papa would say,
and on one occasion, stirred by the sound of Max's anxiety, Liesl decided to get out of bed. From listening to his history, she had a good idea of what he saw in those dreams, if not the exact part of the story that paid him a visit each night. She made her way quietly down the hallway and into the living and bedroom.
"Max."
The whisper was soft, clouded in the throat of sleep. To begin with, there was no sound of reply, but he soon sat up and searched the darkness. With Papa still in her bedroom, Liesl sat on the other side of the fireplace from Max. Behind them, Mama loudly slept. She gave the snorer on the train a good run for her money. The fire was nothing now but a funeral of smoke, dead and dying simultaneously. On this particular morning, there were also voices. The swapping of nightmares. The girl.
Tell me, what do you see when you dream like that?
The Jew. I see myself turning around and waving goodbye. The girl.
I also have nightmares.
The Jew. What do you see? The girl.
A train. And my dead brother.
The Jew. Your brother? The girl.
He died when I moved here, on the way.
The girl and the Jew together. Yeah. Yes. It would be nice to say that after this small breakthrough, neither Liesl nor Max dreamed their bad visions again. It would be nice, but untrue. The nightmares arrived like they always did, much like the best player in the opposition when you've heard rumors that he might be injured or sick. But there he is, warming up with the rest of them, ready to take the field. Or like a timetabled train, arriving at a nightly platform, pulling the memories behind it on a rope. A lot of dragging. A lot of awkward bounces. The only thing that changed was that Liesl told her papa that she should be old enough now to cope on her own with the dreams. For a moment he looked a little hurt, but as always with papa, he gave the right thing to say his best shot.
Well, thank God, he halfway grinned. At least now I can get some proper sleep. That chair was killing me.
He put his arm around the girl, and they walked to the kitchen. As time progressed, a clear distinction developed between two very different worlds. The world inside 33 Himmel Street and the one that resided and turned outside it. The trick was to keep them apart. In the outside world, Liesl was learning to find some more of its uses. One afternoon, when she was walking home with an empty washing bag, she noticed a newspaper poking out of a garbage can, the weekly edition of the Malking Express. She lifted it out and took it home, presenting it to Max.
I thought, she told him, you might like to do the crossword to pass the time.
Max appreciated the gesture. And to justify her bringing it home, he read the paper from cover to cover and showed her the puzzle a few hours later, completed but for one word.
Damn, that's 17 down, he said.
In February 1941, for her 12th birthday, Liesl received another used book, and she was grateful. It was called The Mud Men, and was about a very strange father and son. She hugged her mama and papa, while Max stood uncomfortably in the corner.
Alles Gute zum Geburtstag.
He smiled weakly. All the best for your birthday. His hands were in his pockets. I didn't know, or else I could have given you something. A blatant lie. He had nothing to give except Mein Kampf, and there was no way he'd give such propaganda to a young German girl. That would be like the lamb handing a knife to the butcher. There was an uncomfortable silence. She had embraced Mama and Papa. Max looked so alone. Liesl swallowed. And she walked over and hugged him for the first time.
Thanks, Max.
At first, he merely stood there, but as she held on to him, gradually his hands rose up and gently pressed into her shoulder blades. Only later would she find out about the helpless expression on Max Vandenberg's face. She would also discover that he resolved at that moment to give her something back. I often imagine him lying awake all that night, pondering what he could possibly offer. As it turned out, the gift was delivered on paper just over a week later. He would bring it to her in the early hours of morning, before retreating down the concrete steps to what he now liked to call home. Pages from the Basement